and welcome to Evil in the Stacks, a short-run podcast dedicated to exploring the University of Pittsburgh's horror comics archival collection. I'm Genevieve Newman, a PhD candidate at Pitt, working this year with Archives and Special Collections to put our comics holdings into conversation with our horror studies collections. A little background on me. I'm a scholar and filmmaker working on gender and horror, specifically writing a dissertation on sexual violence across different media and literary texts. Each episode of Evil in the Stacks will begin with a brief history or context for the pieces we're talking about, followed by an interview with an expert on the topic. Today's episode, Trifecta of Golden Age Horror, Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and Haunt of Fear, 1950 to 55, will cover some of the origins of horror comics that we'll see traces of throughout this year's episodes. So, without any further ado, let's get into the background. To get us going, just a bit of background on the era of comics that we're looking at, the early and mid-1950s. So, in a 1960 issue of Comic Art, Richard A. Lupoff used the term Golden Age to refer to the era of comics produced from 1938 to 1956. The titles we're talking about today, EC's Triumvirate, Tales from the Crypt, Haunt of Fear, and Vault of Horror, come about towards the end of this period, debuting in rapid succession in 1950 and ending their runs between 1954 and 1955, right in line with the institution of censorship in the form of the Comics Code Authority. But suffice it to say that this authority is born out of two moments or kind of events. The institution of the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency, and the publication of Seduction of the Innocent. As a media scholar, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that censorship in comics falls behind what we see in Hollywood. So Hollywood censorship drive really begins in and around 1938 with the imposition of the Hays Code. It does bear noting, though, that the book I mentioned, The Seduction of the Innocent, that deeply influenced the shape that comic censorship took, is written by Frederick Wortham, a German-American psychiatrist from about the 1920s through the 1970s. Wortham is, for my film censorship and history buffs out there, a kind of comics analog to Joseph Breen in the Hollywood sphere, who oversaw enforcement of the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, better known as the MPPDA, which is what preceded what we know now as the MPAA rating system. The last thing I'll note, since we're going to get into how mediums tend to bleed into each other over the course of this podcast through the rest of the year, is that a lot of early censorship guidelines we see in Hollywood productions with the Hays Code were already being instituted for whatever reason in the structure of stories in horror comics. That's a story for another time, but just keep in mind that the concept of the good guy always winning and the stark kind of moral implications of these stories, whether in comics or film, does not spring forth fully formed, right? These are constructed frameworks and tropes and patterns, okay? So, with that, let's move into a more specific discussion of Golden Age horror titles and the comics collection at the University of Pittsburgh. All right, so I'm here with Ben Rubin, and I'm going to let him introduce himself, but I know him in my capacity as a graduate student assistant with Archives and Special Collections at the University of Pittsburgh.
My name is Ben Rubin. I am the Horror Studies Collection Coordinator, which is admittedly a very cool title, for Archives and Special Collections at the University of Pittsburgh's library system. So what that means is that I am responsible for building, maintaining, and curating our archival and rare book resources related to the horror genre and sort of other genres of science fiction or other sort of areas that could be associated with horror studies.
Awesome. Okay. So to start off, I have a kind of background question for you. I want to lay some groundwork in terms of the comics that we're talking about today. The University of Pittsburgh Comics Collection holds two of the three titles that I mentioned in my intro. So that's Tales from the Crypt and Haunt of Fear. And those are issues 27 and 24, respectively. Can you talk to me about why you think we have those issues specifically? And how does that kind of acquisition process work? How do or how did Archives and Special Collections come to have these issues, if you know?
Sure. So the comic collection has been in Archives and Special Collections for quite a long time. And so this predates our collecting areas around horror, anything like that. This is from when Special Collections was its own department, which more or less pertained to rare books and ephemeral pieces, like something like a comic or newspaper, or zines, things like that. And this came as just a large donation, so from the Pittsburgh Comics Club, which I don't know the entire history of them, and when this collection came in predated my time here, but my understanding is that they started around the early 70s and lasted for a little over 10 years. And sort of as the group broke up, they donated their collection of comic books as well as fanzines to Special Collections. And so why specific issues are there is kind of the history of that club. The collection in general is very idiosyncratic because it will be one or two issues of one title, and then another title we might have a run of 10 years worth, or we might have five issues, or it'll be sporadic and we'll have issues, you know, 1, 15, and 85. It's kind of whatever they collected, and it sounds like it was a sort of group effort of how that organization operated. So it was a group of science fiction and comic fans here in Pittsburgh, and they formed to coalesce their interests and sort of bring that sort of fandom to light in the city. They did, you know, cosplay and went to conventions, and of course this is when those things were starting to come about. Sort of, you know, originally like Star Trek and stuff like that was starting to have fan conventions, but this was still fairly new. And so just sort of finding other folks, you know, this is the days before the internet, so you had to find people in real life to share your nerd interests with. And so they collected these comics, these fanzines, probably from what they picked up around the city or from their travels, whatever they felt like donating that they didn't keep in their personal collections, whatever other folks may have donated. So it's just kind of reflective of whatever they had at that time when it was gifted to the university in the, I think, late 80s.
And so it sounds like we are primarily kind of dealing with what is or is not an individual people's collections, individual organizations' collections. And so from there, while we can't call any one issue of the title, like, wholly representative, do you think it's fair, kind of building off of that, to call them snapshots of a title or even an era? Based on when they were donated, who collected them, that kind of thing. And is this pretty common in archival collections? I know that was a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly it's a snapshot of that's representative of the organization when it existed. So because we got the collection in the late 80s, any title that's there kind of taps out at that point in time. And because of when it existed from the, you know, kind of early 70s through the mid to late 80s, it's probably what was most easily available to the folks that were collecting. So it is probably going to be heavily represented of that time period. A lot of the stuff that came before might have been either things they already had or items that were fairly easily acquired, probably still were cheap, you know, that hadn't reached the level of rarity and expense that some of those older comics have now. And so it's definitely kind of a snapshot of the time frame in which they were collecting. The comics themselves, and then certainly the fanzine collection is a representative of, like, as the rise of those fanzines kind of came about, and then the ones that were circulating and were available during the time that they were collecting. Whether any of it is representative or important, like, do they pick a specific issue because it's important to that title? I really don't have any insight into that. From what I kind of know about the collection, I would probably say no, because I think it is fairly idiosyncratic in that it just represented the interest of what they had. So, you know, superhero comics are well represented. Those are always, of course, the most popular anyway. Certain titles more so than others, probably, again, had to do with what was most popular at that given point in time, what was most available, and maybe just what kind of captured the attention of that group of, you know, folks when they were collecting.
So I want to dive a little bit into the specific issues that we have in the archives. So we're looking at 27 and 24, Tales from the Crypt and Haunt of Fear, just to reiterate. And so, as you know, Ben, my work focuses on sexual violence and media, specifically horror. So what I immediately noticed about some of the stories, and specifically the first story in Haunt of Fear, is that it features some pretty explicit depictions of domestic violence. So I could talk for days about how this is framed, but what's your kind of perspective on including these kinds of stories in the archival collection, of studying them, that kind of thing? Like, what is the value of having something that is potentially controversial in 2022 in an archival collection?
Well, I mean, archival collections are documents of history. And so, you know, I think that it's important for us to have that history exactly as it was when it was happening. And so if those depictions were common at that time, it's important for us to capture that. And if people are here to study it, they can apply current lenses to reinterpret what that material meant at that time, and, you know, how does it impact our historical understandings of gender violence or anything else. But I don't think any of it should be censored, or that we should exclude these materials because by the current standards they're inappropriate or controversial. It's a part of our history. It's the way that we were telling stories at that time. It was a common trope that was used. It just because it's passé now, I don't think means that we should hide it. Especially at a university, we should be engaging with it, thinking about it, you know, reinterpreting it. You know, and I think it just helps us understand a lot of way cultural contexts come about, how, you know, comics reflect cultural contexts. You know, I know the trope of the women in the refrigerator is common throughout the comics. I think it's something that maybe students that look at it now aren't as familiar with because it's not used as heavily. But is certainly something to study, to kind of see sort of how women were depicted in comics. I think it's also a good representation of sort of understanding to the discrepancies in perceived fandom, that, you know, comics were marketed to boys, and boys were perceived as the only fan base and the only base that were buying comics. We do have women's comics, and I'm using air quotes since you can't see me, that are all like love stories and are, you know, just very stereotypical, I suppose, to their age, that they're being published, the time period. And, you know, or it's Lois Lane, Superman's girlfriend is one of my favorite titles, is, you know, she has to still be identified as attached so that we care enough to read her stuff, but that it still would have been marketed to the, you know, perceived few girls that were reading these materials, and using boys and girls because it was also assumed that these were children that were and teenagers were marketing these to. So I think it also kind of fits into that of like what these companies that were still producing these material, and even the creators, sort of thought of as their audience and what people wanted to consume as their media at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that also could spark an entire conversation about when adolescence became a thing, right?
Sure.
But we don't have to go there.
1940s.
That is yeah. Also a wonderful topic to explore if you are a researcher looking into comic books. I digress, though. So do you think that there's a way to read, like, specifically comics that exist in archives as, like, being read through queer feminist or other kind of radical lenses, right? Political lenses that kind of come about in the years post, or that weren't necessarily in conversation at the time, because there was a lot of feminist work going on in the 1950s, but it wasn't necessarily being put into conversation with comic books necessarily. So do you think there's a way to read these now in that way? And what's the benefit of archival sources specifically in that kind of analysis?
I mean, I think, you know, applying critical lenses to material is important. Certainly within the university context, it's a great way to do that and kind of interrogate and reinterpret and understand these materials. But I think it's also important to kind of understand the context in which they're created. So, you know, expecting things to adhere to a modern sensibility is I think, a little misguided, and that we can't expect these materials to apply to our modern sensibilities. But I think you can use these critical lenses to sort of understand how our cultural contexts have changed, why maybe the way that those comics were, the themes that were portrayed at the time are now sort of deemed inappropriate, why we might not want kids reading those types of things now. You know, all of that, I think, helps us kind of understand our culture better, understand the type of media, the sort of like evolution of literature. All of that, you know, we're constantly kind of re-examining past works and texts and, you know, things that had massive, massive impacts at the time that they came out. Now we, you know, don't embrace with the same kind of, you know, as wholeheartedly, but, you know, they still were a part that had giant impacts and that we can't just ignore them. And so I think being able to have this type of analysis is good. And it just helps us kind of recontextualize the role that they had in the kind of larger development of literacy, larger development of comics, their importance, their continued fandom, you know, despite any sort of currently perceived problems within those comics, they're still hugely popular. And even specific titles that, you know, the woman in the refrigerator trope is in Superman and titles like that that are still wildly popular. That character has evolved and changed kind of over time, which I think is also important as we see something like comics where new creators come in, new writers come in, and use the same character, but that character also kind of evolves with modernity. So yeah, I mean, I think the archives, we should think of them as the, you know, exactly what they are. They're historical documents that help us understand the time in which these materials were created. And sometimes that will be things that are somewhat offensive, but history can be. So it's just what it is, but we need it to understand sort of the larger context of how our literary, comic, film kind of history has developed over time.
Yeah, and if I may, I would add to that, having worked with some of the early Wes Craven Last House on the Left scripts, it also brings to mind this idea that, like, you can't walk into looking at a historical document with an expectation of what its politics are going to be. Those scripts in particular, I've found, are what we would call ahead of their time, but I think that framing might even be a little troubling because it makes an assumption about what that kind of politics is for a particular person, creator, period, etc.
So yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Like, we sort of ascribe our politics or our lenses to creators, to works. We hope that things are ahead of their time, but usually that's a post hoc analysis that we've realized it is. But certainly approaching archival materials, I think, is something that we hear from a lot of researchers and students, is that, you know, they go in kind of with this one idea, this one lens that they hope to apply to it, and then sort of working with the documents themselves, kind of realize organically that, you know, you can't come to it with this perspective, that you have to sort of let the material speak to you, and then you can kind of situate it within the time frame that it was created, and then sort of still then apply these lenses to kind of reinterpret and understand its continued relevance.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of getting into the nitty-gritty here, since we're talking kind of about comparatively old texts, or to put it bluntly, old pieces of paper, right? What does the kind of handling of that, the processing materially look like, and how might that impact how someone accesses, uses, interacts with these materials?
Sure. So, I mean, I love working with old materials, and that's, I think, the beauty of working with a rare book or an archival collection, is to handle the literal materiality. You know, you can handle literally a 500-year-old book is just, it's very neat. So these comics, of course, are not quite that old, but still just getting the you know, humans are fairly tactile, so we, you know, understand things by touching and sort of absorbing our world in a sensory way. And so, you know, the digital spaces, I think, kind of blunt that a little bit. But that idea of, like, actually holding this paper, it gives you a sense of sort of how it was made, what its intentions were. And so something like comics that are seen as very ephemeral, you know, that weren't necessarily, when they were being created, intended for obsessive collecting and hoarding, that they are known for now. So they weren't on the best paper. They're on pulp, which is sort of the lowest quality of paper and kind of came out of the industrial era as books became mechanized, and then sort of the lower kind of genre of literature was definitely relegated to the pulps. And so the idea of pulp fiction, of course, is a description of materiality. And so you saw that with most genres. So whether it was horror or romance or westerns or adventure stories or science fiction, was all published on pulp paper, which was the cheapest, crappiest thing that you could make. High acidity, which helps deteriorate even more. And so comics are part of that. And so you can tell, but you know, it's like newsprint paper. It's just, you can tell by touching it that it's not a high quality. But at the same time, the sort of colorful printing is very high quality. And so you kind of get the juxtaposition of the material paper itself with the amount of care that went into creating the images that are on it, the glossy cover that's in a little bit better shape. You kind of get how these were meant to, you know, hold up over time. You kind of immediately understand why comic collectors sleeve and board all of their materials to help kind of keep them preserved, because this paper isn't going to do it by itself. It is going to deteriorate. You know, comics also kind of were impacted a lot by the paper shortages in the 40s for World War II. And so you saw that sort of initial rise in the 30s of comics, and then sort of disappearing a little bit and becoming more scarce, but the paper becoming even of lesser and lesser and lesser quality. And then the sort of post-war boom and explosion, because kids love these things. There was a huge economic boom that meant that people could purchase them. We saw shifts into paperbacks. All of this sort of like fits in with understanding the literal materiality of how a book or a comic book or any of these things are literally put together, that you miss by looking at it in a digital representation. You kind of understand more of, you know, you can smell them. All of this goes into how do you interact with this item? How do these stories kind of communicate to the reader through actually handling them, seeing the visual imagery, you know, the ink that rubs off on your fingers? All of that kind of contributes, I think, to sort of how we consume the material, why fandoms rose around it, sort of why they're evocative, the sort of, you know, covers that are very, very vibrant. When they sit on a shelf, they grab your attention. They were intended to do that so that you're attracted and walk over to look at one item versus another. You know, all of that kind of comes about by handling the actual materials. That being said, because they are terrible quality, relatively speaking, they can also deteriorate and be hard to handle. And so that's another part that we're constantly needing to sort of address in a rare book or archival space, is how to help promote and have people actually get the opportunity to handle these historical documents, interact with them, while also maintaining their preservation concerns. And so sometimes that means that they might need to be restricted, they might need to be digitized, they might need to have copies made so that a used copy is there so that someone can handle it without further damaging the original. You know, all of that is sort of baked into that professionalization of how we provide access. But it is a concern with trying to maintain that, is that we want people to use these, but we also need to preserve them and keep them for, you know, posterity. And it can be a difficult balance. Comics in particular, kind of hard, because, you know, really that materiality is so important. But it might mean that some issues are readily available for folks to come and consult with, and other ones might not be so. It just kind of is a case-by-case basis, depending on sort of what that specific item looks like.
Yeah, and so before I get to my last question, what's the deal with gloves?
Yeah, so, you know, anytime I tell people I work in a rare book room, that, you know, immediately you're like, well, we have to wear white gloves. And as I think I saw another rare book librarian once say, is we are not Mickey Mouse, we do not wear white gloves. Cotton, particularly, is what usually the white gloves are made out of, is mostly only used for something like a photograph, in which your fingerprints and the oils from your hands are going to immediately damage the photograph. For the majority of paper materials, gloves are unnecessary. Cotton ones, absolutely, you would not wear them because the fibers from the pulp paper are going to snag. Wearing latex or nitrile or some other sort of like more medical type glove could be used in some spaces. Generally, we don't because you lose so much tactile sensation while wearing gloves that you're more likely to rip paper or snag the fibers because you just can't feel what you're doing. So generally, our rule of thumb is just having clean hands. So wash your hands with soap and water, and that's about as good as we can do. Paper's fairly resilient. It'll hold up against some handling as long as your hands are clean. But that's also why when you walk into a rare book room, you know, it's kind of a more sterile environment, which there's no food and drink, the tables are cleaned, all of that kind of goes into it. The materials themselves are housed in acid-free folders and containers to kind of continue to help with, you know, storage spaces that are climate controlled, and all of that goes through it so that it all kind of contributes to that. But gloves are not as common as there seems to be a public perception, which I think probably just comes from media depictions.
And it sounds like there's kind of an ecosystem involved in keeping these things intact, right?
That's, yeah.
The whole process is not one single element, right?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so finally, before I let you go, can you give us a brief understanding of how someone would go about accessing any kind of archival material at the University of Pittsburgh?
Sure. So our rare book and archival materials are open to anybody, so they're not just restricted to the university community. I know that these spaces seem kind of intimidating, but we do want them to be open, and hopefully by people just coming in, you kind of get that experience of it's not that intimidating. We're mostly fairly nice people and want you to come in. So you can find all these materials through our library catalog mostly, or what we call archival finding aids, which are just collection guides. So if you are familiar with kind of using library spaces, usually you're searching through a catalog to find a call number, and that's where a book lives on a shelf. And the rare book resources will be that way. Archival collections, we arrange in boxes and folders. And so we use what we call finding aids, which are collection guides that tells you literally what is in every box and every folder. And we have requesting systems to kind of access that. And so without getting too far into the weeds, you know, Aeon is the system that we use at Pitt. Is a fairly common system among archival and rare book repositories in the U.S. But it's just a way to go in and say that I want to look at this book, or I want to look at this folder or this box of a collection, and you make an appointment and come visit our reading room. So the space in which you consult items is called a reading room. It's a secure and monitored space that just allows us to ensure preservation and security over these materials. You come into one of those generally without any of your materials, backpacks, food, drink, and all that is usually stored away. And you just work with the materials themselves. But everything is requestable. So if you're on the library website for the University of Pittsburgh, you can discover materials, request right through the site. There's ways to contact the department to get further information on requesting and setting up appointments and everything like that. So I largely would just recommend that you visit library.pitt.edu and use the catalog, see what you can find, or try the Ask Us function, which is how to talk to librarians directly, and any messages that are for specific folks like within our department or certain repositories will get diverted to them, and they'll help you navigate how to access and kind of with screenshots and things are a little harder to describe just on a podcast. So
yeah, absolutely. And I will include links for some of those resources in the show notes so that it's easily accessible for people.
One thing with collections is not everything gets processed at the same rate. So we get a lot of materials in, and it takes a while to sort of sort through a collection, arrange it, put it into folders and boxes, describe them, and sort of make them accessible to the public in a meaningful way. And the comics collection is one that is sort of in an in-between state that is a little bit less discoverable as we continue to process and kind of have it ready. One of the benefits of having a little bit more visibility is having someone like Genevieve work with this and start to understand better what's in it and kind of bring attention to it. So if you're not finding what you're looking for, I recommend just getting in touch with us, because it could be that a collection that we have is just sort of in that state of kind of pre-processing, where we're trying to arrange and get it all ready, make evaluations on preservation, sort of putting it together. When we get collections, they're just sort of can be very random. You know, someone cleaned out their home and put everything in boxes. The comics collection was sort of arranged, but arranged in a way that made sense for the comics club, but maybe doesn't make sense for a librarian. You know, getting in touch with us is always a good way to kind of have a better understanding of what types of materials we have if they're not readily apparent through our discovery tools.
So with that, I will thank you, Ben, for coming on and for this amazing conversation. This was so helpful. And thank you all for listening to Evil in the Stacks. Next month, our episode will cover horror hosts in comics and TV. We'll have another great interview and some cool comics and media pieces to talk to you about. Talk soon.